the hits. Forget.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, United Nations countries have agreed to create a treaty that deals with plastic pollution in the world's oceans, rivers, and land. The UN Environment Assembly voted Wednesday at its meeting in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, for a resolution to end plastic pollution. It is the beginning of international negotiations designed to produce a treaty by 2024. Today, we wrote history. Plastic pollution has grown into an epidemic, said Espen Barth Eide. He is Norway's Minister for Environment and Climate and the Assembly's President. With today's resolution, we are officially on track for a cure, he added. Negotiators debated on the resolution for a week. Plans presented by Peru, Rwanda, India, and Japan were used as the basis for a global plan to prevent and reduce plastic pollution. The treaty would cover the production, design, and removal of plastics. It is not always you get such a major environment deal, said Inger Andersen. She is executive director of the UN Environment Program. Andersen called the agreement by representatives of 175 member countries the most significant global environmental governance decision since the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. A recent study by the Pew Research Center says that the worldwide plastic industry is valued at $522.6 billion. The study also reported that 11 million metric tons of plastic end up in the oceans every year. The environmental group Greenpeace said the UN decision is a big, bold step to end plastic pollution. Graham Forbes is head of the Global Plastics Project at Greenpeace USA. He said that until a strong international treaty is signed, the organization and its allies will keep working toward a world free of plastic pollution. This is a big step that will keep the pressure on big oil and big brands to reduce their plastic footprint and switch their business models to refill and reuse, Forbes said.
Alaska's Yukon River has faced major salmon shortages in recent years. The shortages are blamed on warming waters. Officials say record high temperatures last year killed most salmon in the 3,200-kilometer river before the fish were able to reproduce. The losses led both Alaska and Canada to halt their salmon harvests in 2021 in order to make sure that enough fish survived to reproduce for another year. The situation caused local officials to send emergency fish shipments to communities along the river that depend on salmon for food. Scientists have mostly blamed the problems on a series of heat waves in the Bering Sea and North Pacific Ocean from 2014 to 2019. The warm ocean waters affected salmon living in the sea before they returned to their spawning grounds. The collapsed Yukon River salmon harvests caused major financial losses to private fishing companies in the area. The die-offs also hurt native communities, which traditionally store the fish as a year-round food supply. In 2020, fishing companies on the Yukon River earned a combined $51,480. By comparison, they earned $2.5 million in 2019 and $4.67 million in 2018. Last month, the U.S. Department of Commerce declared a disaster for Yukon River fishing for 2020 and 2021, making federal aid money available. Alaska has sent emergency fish shipments to areas affected by the salmon shortages. The shipments came from more productive fisheries in the southwestern fishing community of Bristol Bay and other areas. While the heat waves have passed, their effects have not, said fisheries scientist Katie Howard. She is with Alaska's Department of Fish and Game. "We're still seeing the residual effects," Howard told a state legislative group earlier this month. Climate change may also be affecting what the salmon are eating. Fishing experts say young salmon are likely filling up on nutrient-poor food like jellyfish because warmer waters drive away healthier organisms they normally feed on. "In my opinion, the salmon are starving with climate change," said Brooke Woods. She is with the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission in the Athabascan village of Rampart. "The effects of climate change on freshwater environments have also been studied." Vanessa von Biela is a U.S. Geological Survey research biologist who looked at the rivers, streams, and lakes where salmon spend early and late periods of their lives. Her team found that Chinook salmon show heat stress at temperatures above 18 degrees Celsius. They start dying above 20 Celsius. In the past, Alaskan Yukon water temperatures stayed between 12 and 16 Celsius. But in 2019, temperatures on the Alaskan side were above 18 degrees Celsius for 44 straight days, a recent study found. The effects of warming waters can be reduced by climate-driven glacier runoff, which brings cooler water into rivers and streams. But scientists still expect salmon to begin slowly moving to new areas within Alaska. "Salmon will find a way," said biologist von Biela. But it is going to be hard for communities that are in places where there might not be salmon anymore. I'm Brian Lynn.
International crisis, the invasion of Russian troops into Ukraine, has been one of the top stories in the news in recent days. In today's report, we will explore some of the language that is often used during such crises. You will learn about verb forms, including the simple present, present continuous, and present perfect continuous. Live reporting plays an important part in the news coverage of international crises. Reporters generally discuss events that are ongoing, events that happened in the recent past, and events that are likely to happen in the near future. Let's listen to a VOA news report and explore some of the verb forms.
We're here reporting from the train station in the capital of Ukraine, the city of Kyiv. It's a quiet morning here after several days of violence. We understand that Russia and Ukrainian officials will be speaking today. And in the meantime, many families are using this brief time of quietness to try to get out.
Notice that the reporter used several different verb forms. The report began with the present continuous verb form. The reporter said, "We are here reporting," because the action of reporting is ongoing. The next sentence used the simple form of the verb be. It is a quiet morning here. In this case, the reporter uses the simple present form to describe the general state or mood in the area at the present time. Then the reporter uses an interesting verb, understand. She says, "We understand." This term is common in reporting, but it has a slightly different meaning from what you might expect. In this case, understand means to think or believe something based on what you have heard, read, or seen. Understand is a stative verb, a verb that describes a state. It is used in its simple form. That is why the reporter said, "We understand," instead of something like, "We are understanding." The reporter then uses the future continuous, as in, Russian and Ukrainian officials will be speaking today. In this case, the future verb form suggests that the activity will take place at some point later in the day, and will last for some amount of time. Perhaps a long time, perhaps a short amount of time. During crises, speeches or talks by politicians or experts might include some different verb forms or language than what a live reporter might use. Let's listen to a few words from President Joe Biden's speech regarding the invasion of Ukraine.
"For weeks, we have been warning that this would happen. And now, it's unfolding largely as we predicted."
In this case, President Biden used the present perfect continuous, as in, "We have been warning." This suggests that the action began at some point in the past and continues up to or near the present moment in time. Because the action began at an unclear time, English speakers sometimes use a time expression along with the verb form. Biden, for example, gives a general sense of time by using the words "for weeks." The same structure of time expression plus present perfect continuous appears in all kinds of discussions about crises. For example, you might hear or read something like, "For years, experts have been expecting," or, "For months, officials have been discussing." The next time that you watch the news during a crisis, pay careful attention to the verb forms that speakers use. Ask yourself why the speaker used that verb form instead of another. This process will improve your understanding of the news. It also will help you understand verb forms when speaking in everyday situations or when reading. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Growing tensions in Europe and Asia created a serious conflict for Americans during the 1930s. Most Americans opposed the fascist or military leaders gaining control in Germany, Italy, Japan, and other countries. But they were not willing to take any firm action to stop this growing movement. Americans did not want to become involved in another world war, and they called on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan finally would force Americans to choose between their love of democracy and their desire for peace. The first challenge to America's policy of neutrality came in October 1935. Troops from fascist Italy invaded Ethiopia. Roosevelt did not feel neutral at all. He told his advisors, "Italy is dropping bombs on Ethiopia, and that is war." He sharply criticized the fascist Italian leader Benito Mussolini. Roosevelt issued an order banning Americans from sending arms to either Italy or Ethiopia, and he called on Americans not to send oil or other materials to Italy. Roosevelt's efforts to stop the export of oil and other products did not succeed. But the efforts by the White House played an important part in leading the League of Nations to take economic actions against Italy. Less than 2 years later, civil war broke out in Spain. Spanish fascists led by General Francisco Franco tried to overthrow the democratic government in Madrid. Some Americans went to join the Democratic Army in Spain to fight Franco. But Roosevelt and the Congress agreed that America should remain officially neutral in the conflict. In this way, Roosevelt was meeting the wishes of the American people by avoiding war. But personally, he was deeply troubled by the events in Europe. In a letter to his ambassador in France, Roosevelt wrote, "One cannot help feeling that the whole European situation is blacker than at any time in your lifetime or mine." Another challenge to American neutrality came in Asia. Japan launched a new invasion of China in July 1937. Within 1 month, Japanese forces gained control of what was then called Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. The United States had long supported the nationalist forces of China, and many Americans were angry about the Japanese invasion. But Roosevelt and his administration once again refused to take strong actions against the aggression. For one thing, the American Navy was weak. There was little it could do to stop Japanese aggression thousands of miles away in Asia. And neither Roosevelt nor the Congress wanted to be the first to break America's official policy of neutrality. Franklin Roosevelt made clear in private talks with friends that he understood the serious threat to world peace created by Adolf Hitler and other fascists. He believed that the United States could not remain neutral forever if democracy was threatened in so many countries. However, Roosevelt did little to educate the nation about this threat. Instead, he generally followed the wishes of the majority of people who wanted America to remain neutral. Public opinion in the United States was strongly against any kind of involvement in foreign conflicts. In 1937, Roosevelt made an important speech calling for the world's neutral nations to protect themselves from lawless fascist nations. But many Americans feared that Roosevelt was trying to create a new alliance, and they opposed his efforts. A public opinion survey at the time showed that less than one in three Americans was willing to change the nation's strong neutrality laws to give Roosevelt more freedom of action. In the same year, Japanese planes sank an American gunboat in the Yangtze River in China. But few Americans showed any interest in going to war over the incident. Instead, they accepted Japanese apologies. Americans simply had no desire to fight. Most Americans honestly believed that the best hope for their country was neutrality. One of the most influential supporters of neutrality was Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. He told the New York Times in 1937 that there can be no objection to any action the government may take which tries to bring peace to the world. But that action, he added, must not tie the American people into another world death march. He said, "I very much fear that we are once again being caused to feel that the call is upon America to police a world that chooses to follow insane leaders." Adolf Hitler's Nazi forces moved into the Rhineland in 1936. 2 years later, they invaded Austria. And then, in the following months, Hitler began making demands on the government of Czechoslovakia. Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was afraid that Hitler might start a general European war if he was blocked from gaining control of Czechoslovakia. In September of 1938, Chamberlain traveled to Munich to discuss the situation with the German leader. The result was that Britain agreed to a German takeover of Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain returned to London, promising peace in our time.
The settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
The first reaction of most Americans to Chamberlain's Munich agreement was one of relief. But then public opinion changed. Americans saw that Hitler's Germany now had control of Central Europe. Japan was becoming more powerful in Asia. Chamberlain's weakness only served to show dictators that they could gain land and power through aggression and fear. Roosevelt warned Americans in late 1938 about this fascist threat. "There can be no peace," he said, "if another nation makes the threat of war its national policy."
There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the threat of war. There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the dispersion all over the world of millions of helpless and persecuted wanderers with no place to lay their heads. There can be no peace if humble men and women are not free to think their own thoughts, to express their own feelings, and to worship God. There can be no peace if economic resources that ought to be devoted to social and economic reconstruction are to be diverted to an intensified competition in armaments.
Roosevelt and much of the American public continued to hope that the United States could stay out of foreign conflicts. Increasingly, they understood that war might come, and they began to prepare for possible hostilities. Following the Munich Agreement, Roosevelt requested a large increase in the defense budget. He asked Britain and France to buy arms from American manufacturers to give those companies more experience in producing weapons. And he helped bring about an agreement among nations in North and South America to join together to oppose fascist threats to peace and security. Finally, Roosevelt tried to get Congress to change the neutrality laws. He wanted more freedom as president to resist fascist aggression and help Britain, France, China, and other friendly nations. Congress, however, continued to resist such changes. But events in early 1939 showed that war was on the way. Germany occupied Czechoslovakia and then Lithuania. Franco's forces took control in Spain. Italy invaded Albania. And then Hitler began making demands on Poland. In August, Germany and the Soviet Union announced to the world that they had signed a non-aggression agreement. A week later, Germany attacked Poland. Two days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. Germany's invasion of Poland and the beginning of the war presented a giant challenge to the United States. On the one hand, almost all Americans supported the European democracies opposing the aggression by Hitler, Mussolini, and other fascists. But on the other hand, Americans had no desire to fight in what might be a long and bloody war. The following months would force Americans of all political beliefs to consider this problem. It would be a final period of peace for the United States before events once again drew it into a terrible world conflict.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.